This is Scott Sebring, and you are listening to the Retro Cool Nerd Powcast. It's good listening. Trust me.
Meanwhile, just outside of Gotham City.
Bat antenna deployed. Atomic microphones to power.
Check. 1, 2. Testing.
Bat computer online. In processing.
Affirmative.
Audio tapes to speed. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to podcast. Transmitting.
Greetings, citizens of Gotham, and welcome to the Retro Cool Nerd Powcast, bringing you a retro look at all things cool and a little nerdy, mostly through the lens of the 66 Batman TV show. I am the Retro Cool Nerd, Jimmy the Gent, broadcasting from my secluded study located deep within stately Wayne Manor. And if you followed me over here from the Saturday Morning Serial podcast, which I also co-host, welcome. I hope you enjoy what we got to offer. Now, I want to say thank you for your patience, and in some small ways, it has been rewarded with a new episode. Lockdown and at-home schooling has set us back a little bit here, but I am working hard to bring you lots of groovy content on a regular basis with more conversations with the experts from the 66 Batman universe. This time around, we are discussing possibly the most beautiful, sultry villainess the dynamic duo has ever faced, Joan Collins as the Siren. We also have another segment of Hollywood history with Donald Dadigan from the Hollywood Museum. But before we get to the show, I want to thank everybody that tuned into our last episode. Even more listeners than last time. I am genuinely humbled once again. I want to say thanks to @JohnWiesman for messaging me to say, quote, "Your first two shows were very funny and educational. I especially enjoyed your talk with Scott Sebring, and I'm looking forward to your future guests." End quote. Yes, John, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I plan on having Scott back real soon. For those of you listeners like @Bespin2006 that keep asking me for more Hollywood history with Donnell, today's your lucky day. My co-host from Saturday Morning Serial, Dan the Grim Shade, joins me as we learn more vintage Hollywood secrets from Donnell in another episode of Hollywood History. Well, something I thought I might have to address, and as I predicted last episode, somebody did notice and reached out. And a fan emailed me and asked me if the bat poles were really as big as Burt Ward mentioned. I believe he said they were 65 feet tall. Now, first of all, I'm here to engage in conversations, not push back with any hard-hitting journalism questions, so I accept any answers at face value. So when Burt said it was 65 feet, it was 65 feet. To me. That being said, during a different conversation, Burt told me that they were 85 feet tall. And he could have said they were 100 feet tall, and I would not have blinked. It's his story to tell, and he can tell it any way he wants to. But fans demanded more. Over at the Batman 66 message board, Ben Bentley put together quite a good argument for the height of the actual bat poles, where he dissects the case in detail, provided blueprints of the building, pictures from the set, and used Adam for scale to approximately measure the poles. The short story is, stage 16, where the Batcave set was built, was only 46 feet high. Schematics and blueprints for the set show the rock face covering to the bat poles to be 28 feet 6 inches high. So most likely, a 25 to 30 foot drop is what we had. Maybe 35 feet at the tops. But like I said, it's Bert's story to tell, and when he tells it, he can make it as big as he wants. I will leave the link in the description if you're interested in the full breakdown in the Batman 66 message board. Now, this episode, we're going to narrow the focus of our conversation a little bit to the one villain from the show that has a superpower, and explore not only the original script for the Season 3, Episode 3, Wail of the Siren, but the original treatment for the episode, what was lost, and how they may have done it on a Season 3 budget. But first, let's cover a few Siren facts. The Siren was portrayed by the lovely Joan Collins, who would later gain fame as Alexis Carrington on Dynasty. The Siren's real name was Lorelei Searcy, who was a chanteuse, able to sing 7 octaves. She could use her voice to sing a high note, which would put any man who heard it under her spell.
Batman and Robin, you're finished, I say. For hidden inside of your car, Commissioner Gordon is lurking, and soon he'll tell me whoever you are. Nothing quite so pleasant as a musical interlude, eh, boys?
She had a fascination with evil and historical women who fit that description, such as Mata Hari, Lucrezia Borgia, and Lady Macbeth. She dismissively referred to the other female criminals in Gotham, such as Catwoman and Black Widow, as amateurs. She appeared in 2 consecutive episodes of the Batman TV show, first in Ring Around the Riddler, where she collaborated with the Riddler in a plot to control all the boxing matches. There she mentioned that she also had plans for Batman. She then appeared in The Wail of the Siren, where she used her powerful voice to sing 2 octaves above high C and hypnotize both Commissioner Gordon and Chief O'Hara. She would later put Bruce Wayne under her spell, with plans to have him jump off of the top of his office building after he signed over the Wayne fortune to the Siren. The Siren also had a cameo on the Batman the Brave and the Bold episode, Day of the Dark Knight, trying to escape from Iron Heights Penitentiary, and also in the Batman 66 comic book. As I said, the Siren had the ability to memorize any man to do her bidding by singing a high note, two octaves above high C, with her voice. Women, for some reason, are apparently not affected by this, and earplugs or headphones worked as a good defense. When Robin forced her to sing the antidote note, 3 octaves above high C, Bruce snapped out of her control, but the Siren lost her voice. While under the Siren spell, Commissioner Gordon and Chief O'Hara did not remember their actions, but they never addressed how Commissioner Gordon or Chief O'Hara were freed from her spell. That's kind of a small plot hole, but there are many in the series. But you guys already probably knew that, so let's dig a little deeper. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we've got experts. Speaking of experts, this week I am joined by the man that knows more about the Siren than most men know about their wives, the world's foremost Siren expert, J.P. Pelsman. Some listeners may know him as High C on the Batman 66 message board. By day, J.P. is a sports journalist writing for Forbes.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at J.P. Pelsman. That's at J.P.P.E.L.Z.M.A.N. But why has J.P. chosen Joan Collins, a.k.a. the Siren, as his way into the Batman 66 fandom? Is it the costume? The singing of the note 2 octaves above high C? J.P. answers these questions and many more as I get absolutely schooled about the Siren, Joan Collins, in my latest Bat Chat with J.P. Pelsman.
But, you know, J.P., is to my knowledge, you are the world's foremost expert on Joan Collins and the Siren. And if anybody out there is listening would like to challenge your title, I welcome them too. But for pound for pound, if anybody has any questions about the Siren, you're the guy to go to. So I want to start off our conversation by, you know, talking about, first of all, why would you, you know, a lot of Bat fans want to separate themselves by picking, you know, a deep dive character and focusing on that. So why would Joan Collins be the one? Why would the Siren be your favorite, your focus?
Well, Jimmy, I guess a lot of young males growing up probably gravitated toward Batgirl or Catwoman. I guess for me, the Siren, I just remember at that impressionable age, watching that episode in syndication, her solo episode, not so much the one that she did with Frank, but her solo episode, I was really I have to say, I was kind of blown away by it. I mean, just her presence and just the idea. I'm sure I probably by then, I think the first time I really remember seeing it, I was just shy of 14 years old. I don't know if I'd read Homer's The Odyssey. Don't know if I knew what a siren was at that point. But I certainly knew that she was very interesting and very sexy and somebody that I'm not sure, I wasn't sure if I wanted to meet her or if I wanted not to meet her, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
But certainly had a presence and just very sexy, as I said, very, very mysterious, too. I just thought, and again, I admit, I'm one of the ones that I like evil villainesses. I really don't go for the jocular Catwoman as much as I mean, I love the first season Catwoman.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I mean, when she not conks the henchman over the head so she can have all the loot for herself, I love that scene. I mean, it's just so, to me, it's so iconic. And the fact that she doesn't want a relationship with Batman, she just wants to tell Bruce Wayne to jump off a building. I mean, it's nasty, but in the context of Batman, especially when in season 3, let's face it, was kind of devolving into a sitcom, I think it's kind of nice to see it at least have that season 1 noir feel.
Right, right, right.
And also, she's got that thing, again, going back to season 1, Jimmy, of her mission is to try to find out who are Batman and Robin. And that strikes, that's very comic bookish, mm-hmm. very superhero-ish. Hey, who are these guys? I want to find that out first. And I like that aspect of it. And you know what? I'll tell you a real quick story. I mean, I don't know if you're how big a baseball fan you are, but
big enough to let you go on with your story.
but I bat left-handed and I throw right-handed. Unfortunately, that's a great combination in baseball, but I wasn't good enough to play. But I guess that means I'm a little off-center, so that's why I just gravitated to somebody a little different. And I just think it's too bad she couldn't have had, number one, a two-parter. I know they weren't doling out a lot of two-parters in the third season. Mm-hmm. And also just more time to establish the character, because I think it was a different character than most. I think they did the right casting. And I would like to have seen how they could have developed the character. I think much like Bookworm in season 1, I would like to have seen Siren come back for an encore performance.
Yeah. She's that episode in the third season, I think, is one of the better episodes. Although, I you know, as we've discussed in various forums and on this show before, you know, it's still like pizza. You know, even a bad episode of Batman is still a Batman, so it's sure. kind of good, right?
Sure.
So, but the you know, as we've discussed, the third season tapers off a little bit, but her episode, which I think is the second storyline, third episode, right?
Correct.
Right, is one of the better ones. It's well written. She's got, like you said, she has a defined objective in mind, and this is just before there's still a little money on the set with the set decoration. But you can kind of see where it's going with the blackout curtains and behind everything, behind all the mock-ups, right? But which works in her scenario, which is loosely should be underwater, right?
Correct. Yeah, and they certainly spent some money on her costume. I mean, that mm-hmm. that certainly wasn't off the rack. I mean, it fit her. I think we would all agree it fit her pretty well, mm-hmm. and that was pretty somewhat risque even by 1967 standards. Or even by today's standards. I mean, and so they spent some money on that. In fact, I know from the budget report, it made the budget went over for the Ring Around the Riddler episode because of that, most likely because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it just I give her credit. I think she took it seriously. I think to me that's one villain you couldn't play it to. Campy because the character's over the top to begin with. Let's face it, it's really the only Batman character in the series where they had some kind of a superpower, or if you want to use the Marvel term, a metahuman. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you then play that over the top, it's really out there. So you have to ground it a little bit. So I think Joan Collins gave it the right touch, the right tone for the character.
Where was, I know you get a little verklempt when certain authors mention that she was a virtual nobody when she came around to Batman and the Siren, but Joan had a little bit of a body of work going on right then. This would have been 67, right? 1967.
Correct.
Go ahead.
Very much so, yeah. No, well, yeah, thanks for mentioning, because she had been, I mean, I don't know if it's a sexist term nowadays, but they called it a starlet back then. She was signed to Fox for a good deal of money back then in the 50s. Actually, she started very early. She started when she was 20 in British films for, believe it or not, a big film company in Britain. It was called the Rank Company, which, I can hear the snickering now. But they were one of the bigger film companies in England. But she eventually wound up doing films. First, she did a picture. Her first big American picture was directed by a guy named, very famous director named Howard Hawks. She actually replaced somebody early in filming that he had fired, and it was called Land of the Pharaohs, and that was really kind of her first femme fatale role. She's this, the funny thing is, again, she's supposed to be playing a woman from Cyprus. I mean, that's kind of like Dee Hartford playing Miss Iceland. I mean, mm-hmm. She's not doing any kind of accent either, but they did kind of make her up with a lot of bronzer, but... The thing is that she's supposed to be given to some Egyptian pharaoh as kind of a gift, if you will. But she winds up kind of scheming to make herself his number one wife and pretty much bumps off his other wife. And she winds up being killed herself. She gets sealed in the tomb. But really, she gives a good performance. It is kind of campy, Jimmy, but... it's her first real femme fatale role, and she's really all of 21 or 22 when they're filming. And it's a lot of responsibility. I think she pulls it off pretty well, and that was what the impetus for Fox to sign her. And then she had a number of roles for Fox over several years. The biggest role for Fox that she did was a femme fatale. She was a comic femme fatale in a film called Rally Round the Flag Boys, where she's this suburban woman who's trying to seduce Paul Newman away from his happy household with his on-screen and off-screen wife, Joanne Woodward. She does fail there. She also did a movie. She was loaned out, as they said, in the business to MGM for a movie called The Opposite Sex, where coincidentally her character is named Crystal, and she's trying to... steal Leslie Nielsen, of all people, away from his girlfriend. And finally, in a movie you may have seen, she's in the last of the Road pictures with Hope and Crosby, The Road to Hong Kong. She's basically Robert Morley's henchmall in that movie. This was 1960. It was filmed in 61. It came out in 62.
And where does Star Trek fall into that timeline?
Well, what happens then is after that movie, she kind of took a hiatus, which a lot of actresses did back then. She wanted to start a family. She had two children, a daughter, Tara, in 1963, and a boy, Sasha, in 1965 with Anthony Newley, the famous singer, songwriter, actor who she had married. And so she kind of gets... dips her toe back in the water, but by then she's really not in films anymore. So in 66, she starts getting back into it. She's in a series called, in September 66, she's in a Man from U.N.C.L.E. episode. She's in a show called Run for Your Life with Ben Gazzara. And then in February 1967, she shot, and it appeared, it ran in April 67, the famed Star Trek episode, City on the Edge of Forever, where Captain Kirk falls in love with her character, but he's forced to sacrifice her because if not, the Nazis would have won World War II. And that that is, it's considered a role that people still talk about to this day, the fact that she really could play a good girl very convincingly. And that I don't know if that got her on the radar for the Batman appearance, but it couldn't have hurt, let's put it that way.
Sure. And so, quote, virtual nobody, end quote, is highly overrated. I mean, yeah, she had quite a body of work, and you could say she was very much an up-and-comer.
Well, she was certainly in demand on the guest star circuit. I mean, I think the thing was, I mean, she only took a certain amount of roles because obviously she had a prominent English accent. You couldn't cast her as the girl next door unless next door was Buckingham Palace. But, you know, she had a name, she had a reputation, and she still was, at least on TV, was a name. And, in fact, the funny thing is, the day before Wail the Siren aired, she appeared another meaty guest star role, another lead guest star role. And mind you, these are all lead guest star roles. None of these are back-of-the-credits roles. These are all right. Top guest star roles. She appeared the night before Wail the Siren aired. She appeared on Batman's former competition, The Virginian, on September 27th, 1967. Playing a saloon owner in Wichita, Kansas, who moves to Wyoming when she's bequeathed a ranch. Now, I don't know. I've never been to Wichita, but I can't imagine many women in Wichita speak like Joan Collins, but that's just a guess.
Right. Maybe she could have been a transfer, inherited it from somebody, won it in a poker game.
It could have been. And I know a lot of people. I know a lot of English people did migrate to the U.S. in the 1800s, but still, it was called The Lady from Wichita. Again, no offense to people in Wichita, but I don't think they speak like they were born in London. That's just me.
Mm-hmm. And then, along comes Batman.
Yes, I that is one thing I still would love to know. It's unfortunate that the one thing. If you, for the most part, there's no correspondence, unfortunately, because I've certainly delved into this, Jimmy, to try to find out if he corresponded with her management. She was at the time rep by a boutique agency called the CMA Creative Management Agency, and because she didn't have, I mean, obviously her husband at the time, he was making tons of money. I mean, it was just, it wouldn't keep going like that because he was about to be in one of the colossal flops of the 1960s called Dr. Doolittle. But then he would go on to a great career. He would still have his nightclub act. He was certainly in demand. But she didn't have to act all the time. But I just have never found any paperwork from Dozier of how he got in touch with her or anything like that. I mean, obviously it was maybe just a phone call to her agent at the time. That's the unfortunate thing. Obviously, some business was done via phone, so I don't have anything to figure out how Dozier contacted her, how she got on his radar, because let's face it, that's the other thing. She was 34 at the time, and he did tend to skew older, even with female villains. I mean, just look at Tallulah Bankhead. But, hey, he did find Julian. Obviously, she's the same age as Joan. They're both still around. Still with us, thank goodness. So, you know, who knows how they got in touch, but
maybe they were looking at her for the Londinium episodes because of her accent.
That's a good question.
And they said, you know what, you need your own show, you need your own episode.
Maybe, yeah, who knows. That's a good question. And that's, you know, I do have, I can tell you this though, I have all the paperwork from the episode. Mm-hmm. I have all the scripts. I have all the shooting schedules. I have all the budgets. And I will say this, though. One thing I think, she did have to do the walk-on in the Riddler episode. So maybe that helped the fact that maybe somebody with a bit bigger name at the time wouldn't have wanted to do that because that was a little less money for a day and a half of work.
Right.
This is a fun thing though. The second day she worked the last 2 days of the Riddler shoot, and the funny thing about that was, It must have taken so long to put that wig on her, Jimmy, that she had a 12:30 p.m. report to the set and a 3 p.m. on-set call. I guess that's how much time they were allowing to, I don't know, to fit the wardrobe too, maybe, but to fit that gown. But also, they weren't taking any chances on how long it might take to put that wig on her.
Well, yeah, and makeup, right? So
and makeup, yeah. Too, and makeup, too. And she said in her book that that the wig was so heavy that she came home each day with a bad migraine from carrying it around all day.
Does she, you know, again, I'll probably bring this up more than once while we're talking, but you are the expert. So I want to ask you, do you know, did she reflect fondly on that character? And does she talk about the siren at all in her book? Do you know if she had maybe photographs around her house or anything?
She unfortunately, I don't know how she actually did, unfortunately, call the character ludicrous, which I give her credit, though, because she gave it her all. I mean, I think the one, I don't know how fondly she reflected on it. I mean, she later on said that the children enjoyed being on set. I'm sure they enjoyed meeting Adam, I would assume. And she did say, you know, that Adam by that point was kind of frustrated because even though this was only the second and third episodes aired, they were the seventh and eighth episodes shot. And she did say that Adam was kind of getting frustrated with the way the scripts were, and maybe Adam could see the writing on the wall that the show was not long for the world. I thought that was interesting. And Adam said in his book that the director, George Wagner, who was an old-time director who directed monster movies and westerns and stuff like that back in the day, and also directed Otto Preminger's arc, that he, for some reason, really berated her mercilessly and that Adam had to console her between takes.
Oh. He's a good guy on and off set. But, yeah, like you said, she mentioned that he kind of saw the writing on the wall and was worried about his post-Batman career.
Correct, yeah. He was worried very much about being typecast, and she said in her book that at the time she didn't know what he meant, but then she realized that years later that after Dynasty, she was pretty much typecast as being the
bitch.
B-I-T-C-H. Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't know if you wanted me to say it, but yeah, that she was just getting those just super bitch roles after Dynasty. So she said she really didn't understand it in 1967, but 25 years later, she knew exactly what he meant.
Let's talk about, I would call it a tag these days. What would you call that end cap or that bookend that she appeared in at the end of The Riddler?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of, yeah, I guess connective tissue, maybe.
Yeah, like a teaser, maybe.
It was both. It was a tag and a teaser because it really just, it was interesting because it's really the one time that they tied the two episodes together in that they introduced her in the middle of the episode. That, I mean, there's no way you can really not run those two episodes back to back in syndication.
Right.
You really have
to
run
them back-to-back. It's almost a three-parter, yeah.
Yeah. It really doesn't work if you don't run those back to back. So it's kind of interesting to me how they set that up. The problem though is let's face it, it's kind of shoehorned into that Riddler episode. I mean, if he's got this drug that he's giving the boxers, why does he need Siren? Really doesn't make a whole bunch of sense other than the fact that they wanted to introduce the character. Again, I'm not complaining about seeing Joan more, but
sure. And possibly, you know, use her name. Like you said, this was the seventh episode shot.
Correct.
And the first one aired, so they want to get the Riddler, Frank Gorshin, in there and get that name for, you know, the premiere of season three. And then also a little smattering of her blossoming star power.
Well, I think also, let's face it, I think they wanted to get a sex symbol in there.
Yeah, get some ratings.
as a sex symbol. They knew at this point they weren't going to have Julie Newmar around anymore. I think that die had been cast by then. Mm-hmm. They knew she wasn't doing the show anymore. I mean, people don't realize by then she had already signed on to do a movie in Europe called Monsieur Lecoq that was never completed. And with Zero Mostel, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I think she was trying to actually get out of the Catwoman typecast, to be honest with you, although we'll never know. And I said, I don't blame her. She's not going to say that.
Right.
You don't want to disappoint the fans. But anyway, I just think they wanted to, I mean, I'm not here to talk about Catwoman, I get that. But I'm sorry for the tangent, but I think they wanted to get, let's face it, you want to get, I mean, there's no question, you know, that show was also trying to appeal. But that's why they signed Yvonne. They were trying to appeal to the upper male demographic, which I think they felt they had kind of, even with all of Julie's appearances in season two, they felt was not doing well, that male that whatever 18 to 49 or whatever male demographic wasn't doing all that great.
Mm-hmm. And she was really the only one. So now in season three, we've got Batgirl, especially in the premiere, we've got Batgirl and Joan Collins in a pretty hot silver miniskirt. Although Batgirl's not allowed to be overtly sexual or even a little sexual, as I recall. They want to up that, like you said, the younger male viewers, the older male viewers, or maybe just male viewers in general.
Yeah, I think they were definitely going for that. I mean, that's, Yvonne has said that. I mean, Yvonne said that when she was asked about it, that they were looking for older male viewers when they hired her, and younger and the young female viewers.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that when she made appearances, you know, adolescent girls would come up to her and want her autograph. So mm-hmm. they certainly were spot on with that, that they wanted a role model they could look up to, that they wanted someone they could identify with. It's just unfortunate. The unfortunate thing is that by putting the episode up, speaking of Batgirl, by putting the episode up so quickly as the third episode of the new season, they wound up cutting out one of Joan's scenes, which was shot to throw in that, and this had nothing to do with Yvonne, throwing in that awful Batgirl scene song.
Right, so they could, I've heard you talk about that before, so that they, so probably presumably so Dozier could get his money from
get
that theme song.
Yeah.
And that unfortunately falls under, you know, just show business, the business that is show, right?
Yeah, and I mean, could you throw that in the, I don't know, maybe the Endless Egghead Olga episode, you know, trilogy, three-parter that you mash into a two and a one, or even Londinium, where nothing happens for three parts? I mean, it's an interesting story. Your listeners can determine it.
Could this be the end of our episode? Is JP under the siren spell? What is it about the sultry songstress that makes a man devote his free time to a TV show that is over 50 years old? Tune in after the break. Same POW channel. Same POW cast.
This is an ABC color presentation.
Don't forget to join us right here every three or four or five-ish weeks or so for Saturday Morning Serial, the podcast that explores the themes of Saturday morning TV, which not only did we all grow up with, they've also been growing up with us. So join Dan Grimshay, Mark E., Jimmy the Gent Lazinski, and Johnny Heck, plus a whole host of celebrity guests, cameos, and recipe tips. Viewer discretion is advised because we do sometimes say fuck and shit and what the fuck. Saturday Morning Serial. See you soon.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Mom, I can't find the sugar.
Welcome back to another installment of Hollywood History with Donnell Dadigan. Donnell is the owner and curator of the Hollywood Museum, located on the corner of Highland and Hollywood Boulevard in Hollywood, California. I have to say, we had a surprising amount of feedback from our chat with Donnell last time, so I was excited to have her back to share some more secrets about Tinseltown. And once again, the delightful Donnell does not disappoint. Hopping in on this conversation is my friend and co-host from the Saturday Morning Serial, Dan the Grim Shay. So let's just throw it to the three of us in the studio now. The first time that I was at the museum was for the Batman 66 exhibit, the Holy Hollywood History Batman, the 1966 exhibit. That's yes. That's a mouthful of a name. And we shared pictures on the website before, and one of the questions I get a lot about that I wanted to make sure that I asked you was how the exhibit was up on the third floor, and you have just a one kind of freight elevator, but everybody wanted to know how did you get the Batmobile up to the third floor, and now you have a DeLorean, right, a time machine from the Back to the Future.
Yeah, so, well, those fly.
Well, I guess that one's a little, you're right, Dan.
Yeah, but the Batmobile, I'm curious.
But can you reveal some of the secrets of the museum?
Well, yes. So for the DeLorean, the time machine, of course, we just opened a window and the DeLorean flew in. And no. But I do, it's amazing. The building is a solid poured-in-place concrete building reinforced with steel. And it was originally built as a Hollywood Fire and Safe building in the teens. And so it withstood quite a bit of weight. And the top floor was used to store automobiles. Oh. The folks like Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, Rudolph Valentino would store their 12 and 16 cylinder cars, these great, gigantic, huge cars. They would store them in the building while they were on tour for the latest film, or while they may have been on location. And so knowing that, I was just enthralled because the freight elevator holds 13,000 pounds. So we could put all cars. I've had Marilyn Monroe's limousine on that elevator, taken to the second floor where we had a phenomenal Marilyn Monroe exhibit, which we do have every summer in honor of her birthday and her passing to commemorate these two very important dates for her. But getting back to what you asked, yes, the Batmobile was driven into the elevator and it was raised up to the third floor. It's still on the third floor today, along with the DeLorean from Part 3. That's the hero car from Part 3. We have a DeLorean that was featured in Part 1. And, of course, we have Marty McFly's black truck, pickup truck. And we have right now four cars on that floor.
That is I'm kind of taken aback by that. I wasn't expecting that little piece of history that was a bit of a – was it a secret garage for the Hollywood elite back in the early days of Tinseltown? And
it's interesting that you asked that, Jim. I'm not sure that it was a secret garage, but it certainly was a location where valuables were stored. Uh-huh. And I guess if the elite could afford to put their cars there, or maybe we could say that.
The building was originally the Hollywood Fire and Safety Board building?
It was built for the Hollywood Fire and Safe Company, and it was a storage facility, but a high-end storage facility with lots of safety precautions taken in place. And what Max Factor loved about this is that the building couldn't be burnt down. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that years ago, when he first started this makeup business, interestingly enough, they used explosive charges to mix colors into the powder products that he sold. And well, so
feels like
he needed, you know, it's a little bit of history, you know, when you think about it. So He loved the fact that it was a poured in place, solid concrete building and fireproof. And that's what the storage facility advertised that it was a fireproof building.
That's pretty amazing. And then Max Factor took it from there and made it the foundation of the that we talked about. That part made it onto the show last time. The part where you bought it, and we talked about you restoring it, and all the time and effort you put into that. But I did want to circle back to the Marilyn Monroe exhibit.
Uh-huh.
You put that up. You said on her birthday and the date of her passing.
Yes, so Marilyn Monroe, you know, she is the most popular female actress in the world, has been, is, and most likely will continue to be. And so we always open the exhibit annually on her birthday, June 1st, and it goes through the summer months, and we do a special celebration for the anniversary of her passing on August 5th. And we have so many visitors from so many Marilyn Monroe fan clubs from around the world that come to pay homage to this great Hollywood icon. And they love to come and see whether it's we're displaying a personal piece of furniture, one of her hand mirrors, a costume from one of her movies, her shoes. People are always interested to know, what shoe size was she really? What dress size was she really? Uh-huh. You know, all of these things. And, makeup that was used during her time, whether it was personal makeup or makeup from the many films she appeared in. And one of her makeup artists, her personal makeup artist, became a friend of the museum. And sadly, he passed away. But we received a lot of makeup from him that he had saved that he said that she had touched and he had used on her. So, you know, it's always fun to think about. It's not only the exhibits, not only have the typical photographs that you see throughout the world or in fan magazines from Once Upon a Time. We have those, the posters from her films, iconic photographs of her. Whether it was her singing Happy Birthday, Mr. President, or even photographs of her with John F. Kennedy, photographs from films, backstory photographs, you know, when the cameras weren't rolling on stage. But it's these items and artifacts that you could find only from people who worked with her on a personal basis or from her personal home collection inside her home that made it to the auction house. And that's always very interesting because most of these artifacts were put in storage by the Strasburg family because everything was left to the Strasburg family. Lee Strasburg was her acting coach, and she left everything to him. And the family, he passed away, of course, after she passed away. But the family decided to auction everything off 36 years after her passing because Marilyn Monroe lived for 36 years. Uh-huh. And so they waited until many of these artifacts came to pass. And one of the costumes that we have, well, actually, it's a personal gown that we have that she appeared in the USO show in Korea. When we received it, I have to tell you, we opened the box. And the fragrance of Chanel No. 5, which was her favorite perfume, the fragrance just came wafting out of the box and just permeated the room. And I have to tell you that dress, I don't know how they shipped it, but it came to the museum with an armed guard.
Whoa.
And, of course, we had the sign for it and everything, but they wanted to take no chances.
Right. Yeah. Do you own some of those pieces that, or do they belong to the museum? The display seems kind of rotates a little bit. I noticed it has sometimes the objects in it that varies from time to time.
Yes. So the Marilyn Monroe exhibit, there is a Marilyn Monroe exhibit at the museum at all times.
Right.
It grows in size and shrinks in size depending during the time of the year.
I see.
And I am thrilled to say that the museum is comprised of the museum's, the exhibit is comprised of the museum's collection, fans from all over the world, major Marilyn Monroe collectors. It's an amalgamation of so many different groups, of diverse individuals and organizations that enjoy participating.
So,
but I will say.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Go on.
I was just going to say it's fair to say that people contact you and say, I've got this really great Marilyn Monroe piece. Do you have room for it for the birthday exhibit or for the passing exhibit? Or do you seek them out when you see something that you have to have? Do you more seek them out to display it in your museum?
Well, you know, Jim, that's a great question because I think it's a combination of both. And of course, we have to vet the individual or the organization. And then, of course, the artifact we definitely have to vet. And we're so thankful we have so many professionals that work with the museum to make sure that we're always showing authentic, real artifacts at the museum.
Do you have anything on your wish list right now?
Everything. But I will tell you, and I suppose if somebody looks it up, they can find it out. At one point in time, there was a Marilyn Monroe exhibit about 15 years ago, and we decided this sounded really very interesting. And so it came out from the Midwest, and I took one look at it and wasn't so sure. I had the folks from LACMA, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and their textile division take a look at the clothing element of it. And we found it that with the clothing element, certain parts of it couldn't be because in the early 1960s, they didn't have plastic zippers, and bugle beads were not made with a certain type of material yet. So interesting what you can find. And we had the honorary mayor of Hollywood, Johnny Grant, who was my best friend in Hollywood until his passing and in 2008. But we had him look because he was personal friends with Joe DiMaggio. And he remembered some wonderful times that he shared with Joe when Joe was married to Marilyn Monroe. And so I said, I need for you to look at all of this because there was a fishing tackle box that belonged to Joe DiMaggio and a bathrobe and a pair of slippers. And I don't know if your listeners know it or not, but Johnny Grant was the honorary mayor of Hollywood, knew everything about Hollywood, presided over the Walk of Fame star ceremonies until his passing. And he did 69 or 71, depending on whose number you want to accept, of the USO shows overseas. And he, his mentor was Bob Hope, of course, because of the USO shows. He learned quite a bit from Bob and also Gene Autry, the cowboy who ended up owning the Angels baseball team. And I was so surprised when I showed Johnny Grant this fishing tackle box, and there was a Marilyn Monroe ID card also from the USO show. And so regarding Joe DiMaggio and the fishing tackle box, he looked at that box and he said, Joe got to the point in his life where everything had to be first class. You see this tackle box? There's nothing first class about it. Organized is of good quality in this box, whether it's a fishing line or a lure or a hook, nothing. And my nickname is my initials, Dee Dee. And he said, Dee Dee? He said, I don't see it. So then I showed him the bathrobe And he said, oh, he said, he would never wear something like this. This is what you get in a motel when you go to somewhere maybe in the desert and they have a bathrobe for you. And those slippers, well, those are cheap slippers that they provide to you. And so he said, this is impossible. This would have never been Joe DiMaggio's. He really liked elegant quality clothing. And in fact, all of his suits were custom made. His shirts were custom made. He said he would never keep anything like this as his own. Maybe he'd wear it if he went to that motel, but he would never keep it for his own. So I was like, oh my God, you know, my heart just dropped. And then Jim, I said to him, well, I have this USO ID of Marilyn Monroe's. You know, Johnny, you have 69, 71 of these USO ID certificates. I said, I need for you to take a look at this and tell me, is this accurate? And so he looks at it and he says, oh, he said, 1953, 1954. He said, you know, he said, this USO ID is laminated. I said, yeah. He says, do you think there was such a thing as lamination in the early 50s? I said, I don't know. He said, no way. He said, this is a copy of her real one. He said, which many books carried a photograph of her USO ID. And he says, this is a copy. He says, it's not real. So it's a long way around to tell you that, yes, we receive all sorts of artifacts, but we have to vet them properly. And sadly, this entire exhibit had to be packed up because it didn't make sense to us. It was, and we knew that it was not authentic. Later on, when it was displayed elsewhere, there was a set of electric hair curlers, and I believe it was the trademark and copyright and the actual number of that item was traced back to hair curlers from 1965.
That's
true. What year did Marilyn Monroe die? 1962.
Yeah.
So there was a problem. But luckily, we never put the exhibit on display. But, you know, sometimes you learn the hard way. And, you know, it's amazing what you can find. Every day is like a treasure hunt when we meet with collectors and, you know, different folks from the film industry, from television, and from new digital projects, you know, that have your favorite stars and the clothing and the artifacts. It's so much fun. You know, you never know what you're going to find. It's truly a treasure hunt.
It sounds like you found my robe and slippers at one point.
Well, yeah, I really, dig that that detective work that you do at vetting all the items. Like I was very familiar with some of the work that went into the Batman pieces and checking them out, and a couple things didn't make it.
Dan Brown.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, Jim, it's really interesting. And really, I think one of the strengths of the Hollywood Museum is that we have a great family of professionals who know about this. You know, this type of vetting and authentication cannot only rest on one person. You have to be able to call specialists in each of these genres to be able to ask the questions and get responses that you can rely on.
Of course, this isn't just my generosity. It's part of Canada Dry's $1 million sweepstakes. I adore Canada Dry ginger ale. It's deliciously less sweet. And who wants to be sweet anyway? So have a Canada Dry ginger ale while you're mulling over this momentous decision. Me or $1 million?
For details, see the Canada Dry Joan Collins sweepstakes display in supermarkets.
What evil times are these? Will JP find an interesting story? Does Jimmy bring up the original teaser trailer script? Answers now!
What got me to being a Batman collector was, I actually happened to buy from an outlet once a photo of Shivy Aberg in the bikini from the Surf's Up Joker's Under.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was thanking them, I said, let me know if you come up with any other stuff. And this was in 2000. And I promise you, I'll make this work for you. And so so I get an email a few weeks later, and they say, yeah, we came up with these contact sheets. I know what a contact sheet was. And it was six contact sheets from Whale of the Siren, and it's 12 photos on a sheet. And they said, okay, and they offered them to me, and I said, sure. And I bought them a transaction off of eBay. And I see Joan in this, she's wearing this mini mesh dress and skirt. And I'm saying, but standing behind her are the henchmen, Allegro, played by Mike Mazurki, Andante, played by Cliff Osmond, and they're wearing their outfits. They're wearing their henchmen outfits. I think to myself, I know they didn't have dress rehearsals. I'm saying, what is this? So it didn't make any sense to me. And so later on, when I was able to buy a copy of the script, I found out that this was a scene that was shot and deleted, where Siren's supposed to be in her lair. She's just finished a concert as Lorelei Cersei, her alter ego.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, she's taking off her makeup in front of a mirror, and she's discussing her next caper, which is to take Bruce Wayne's money. And she's discussing how she doesn't even want to sing anymore. She just wants to be evil. She just wants to be a criminal. And now, granted, I understand it's maybe more exposition you didn't need. I think it's also interesting that she's saying she could make money legitimately, but she doesn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting, as opposed to all these villains who, they really don't have any way to make money legitimately. This is what they do. They're criminals. This is someone, like, it's unfortunate that she does hypnotize Bruce, and that this would be the perfect person for Batman to say, you know, I can't do an Adam like Scott can do it, but, you know, with your talent, you could be such an asset to humanity, Siren. You know, give it up. You know, give up crime, you poor deluded creature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could do so much good for the world. And instead, she just wants to be evil. But, and that's kind of what got me into the whole. So inadvertently, those photos, that contact sheet got me into understanding that there's this whole world behind the scenes of scenes that were shot and never aired, and that there's scripts and all these other things in the Dozier file. So inadvertently, that kind of got me, Jimmy, into being a historian of the show, and not just obviously those episodes of Joan, but all the episodes, to discover, hey, what stuff happened that we don't know about that never appeared on screen. So it's funny in the way that kind of was a gateway for me to just want to know more about the show and know as much as I could about the show.
So I have two follow-up questions about that little scene. And this is deep cut, so if you're only a casual fan of the 66 show, you might want to go make yourself a sandwich. But but I want to know that. So that, when does that scene in the script take place? Is this before she goes to, or in lieu of going to Commissioner Gordon's office and hypnotizing him?
I should have made that clear. You can see it on the aired episodes. Basically, when they come back from the middle break, After Bruce and Dick, after Alfred has sprayed Commissioner Gordon with bat sleep, and he brings him up to the study,
mm-hmm.
and then they go to break, and Siren appears in her Siren garb, and she's kind of primping herself. The reason she's primping herself is because originally it's like she's just changed back into Siren. She's just, yeah, because she had been Laurel and Cersei.
Just got done with her concert, yeah.
Yes, in a concert, in more normal clothes, and now all of a sudden she's reappearing as Siren. So that's why she's making an entrance, and why Andante and Allegro are waiting for her. So yeah, that's a good question. I should have made it clear. So that scene would have been after she's playing the harp and saying how she will control Bruce Wayne's fortune, and before she reemerges to make the phone call.
Mm-hmm. And does that scene, have you, does that, I manage, maybe it does exist somewhere, but have you ever seen it on YouTube or in any collector's
I don't think,
vaults?
I wish it existed somewhere. I doubt it does. That's why every time I hear about outtakes or something, I'm always hoping, but unless it's buried deep in a Fox vault somewhere, I have to think it's bit the dust. And also, I should add, there's another, I have to think this was filmed too, because otherwise, Jimmy, this makes no sense to me. I mean, that's, think about this. In the garage with Gordon, she's got a different hairstyle and a different costume. Now, why
right.
are you going to have a different costume and a different hairstyle? Now, I know that's a different day, so they didn't restyle her hair. That was a different day, so it's a day where they didn't bother to put on the wig and everything. Okay, I get that. But still, you got a different costume. You've got a whole different costume for a scene that lasts about 30 seconds. Now, what happens there is that when Batman and Robin came back, they had a whole scene with Batman and Robin. Now, I can't confirm this one was shot. I don't know. But I'm guessing it was, because why would you have a whole costume change for a 30-second scene? Now, there's a scene in the final script where Batman and Robin come down to the garage, and she confronts them. And she just makes small talk with them. And the joke is supposed to be that Gordon's already in the trunk, and they don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes sense to me that would have been shot, because why would you just shoot a 30-second scene and have, it makes no sense to shoot a 30-second scene in the garage. I don't know. It just doesn't make, with the costume and everything. I just don't understand why you would do that.
Right. I mean, that, like you said, that's a lot of money. Just to have them on stage, whatever they're wearing, that's money. And then if
exactly.
it's a completely separate outfit, they did reuse a lot of costumes on that show. So there, I guess there's a small chance that you know, it's one of those. But she is kind of Joan Collins is kind of a petite frame, and might need special accommodations as far as the wardrobe. So
yeah,
yeah,
I mean,
it doesn't make sense to put all that money out there and not have anything come out of it, other than, you know, maybe some on-set photos.
And let's face it, neither one of those outfits were off the rack. Those weren't those were specially done. Those mm-hmm. They spent money on those costumes.
Especially her silver one, yeah.
And both of those silver ones.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the original. I think it's really interesting. You sent me a copy of the script for the original teaser that introduced the siren. So it looks like they abandoned that so that they could jam her into the middle of the Riddler episode. But this teaser, the original teaser for her, for the siren, is very nautical in theme and starts off with shots of boats on the rocks and somebody's following a scream or something. You want to talk a little about? Tell me a little bit about that. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, I think. Thanks, Jimmy. I mean, what surprised me about that, I don't know if it was a case of Stanley Ralph Ross kind of going rogue, if you will, or something, because I was just surprised with what he wrote there. Because let's face it, I mean, I don't know if he didn't get the memo that season three, maybe he didn't, because let's face it, he's writing this in early June.
Right.
And
right.
maybe he didn't get the memo that, you know what, we've got no budget.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's, now granted, boats crashing on the rocks, you could maybe get some stock footage. I get that. But now he's definitely got a scene where Joan's going to be on the beach, or at least on a hilltop. That's, I don't see how you could do that indoors. That's,
right.
That's got to be shot outdoors. I don't understand. There's no way you can do that. He's got certainly a bunch of extras, at least. I just don't understand what he's thinking. I mean, it's an interesting scene, and he's certainly thinking very literal, as I mentioned before with the old ancient Greeks. He's thinking very literally about sirens making boats and ships crash on the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wonder, I mean, I'd like to get, you know, what was your thought when you read it as far as, I mean, what's he thinking of the budget?
I feel it's much more interesting. You know, like you said, it's before there's any restrictions. So it's obviously a first draft because they cut it. But there's a lot more character development in this, two, three pages, right? Or how many pages is it, yeah, maybe?
About 10 pages.
Yeah, but it's a lot of money for that amount of time. For that, like, you go from the water, then, you know, we see the ships crashed on the rocks, which you said, maybe we got some stock footage of that. And maybe they're trying to work in Batman and the Batman boat, you know, working the bat boat in there somewhere. But they go right to the hospital. Yeah. They go right to the hospital to talk to one of the victims of the crash. That's a whole nother, you know, that's a whole nother set and a whole amount of money.
That's another set, yep.
Yeah. And then we're back to the Siren's Grotto. But you know, that's all, they've already had that. You know, so they just cut out all this, you know, couple thousand dollars worth of pages here and get right to her in the grotto.
Yeah, and I got to say this. Tell you what, though, if that was a Batman 66 movie, and even if I weren't a Siren fan, I'd probably watch it.
And her theme or her crime or motive is obviously different, right? She just wants to take over the world.
Yeah, which I mean, it doesn't make sense. I don't like the whole explain it to people. Her plot is that my problem is he's it's kind of like what I said before about her performance not going over the top, is that Ross in the outline, if you will, what I call it, they call it a teaser. I call it an outline because obviously teaser already means something different when you watch the show. But in his outline, her overall plot is he has this device of something called the Winnetka Winds. I guess maybe he spent some time in Chicago or whatever, and that there's this super wind that comes around every 17 years, and that she feels if she broadcasts her stunning note from the top of the highest building in Gotham City and uses high amplitude sound equipment, the note will somehow carry around the world and put all the men in the world in her power.
Right. And that's what, I mean, that's kind of interesting and some nice writing is that's why the boats were crashed on the rocks. It's revealed that she was taking pieces of her speaker that she needs to build. Part of it is she needs to build the world's largest amplifier and loudspeaker. So she's, boats. Yeah.
I like the ambition of the plot. I'm not buying the pseudoscience of the wind. I just feel like putting something on top of her powers already.
It's like a hat. It's like a hat on a hat.
Hat on a hat. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hat on a hat. But I do like the ambition.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I've said many times, and I know it's a tangent, but it's still siren related. Siren related. Okay, not pronounce the word siren correctly. That's terrible. I mean, my biggest disappointment in the 66 comics is every time they introduced Siren, either she was just a pawn in somebody else's plot or she just had the most banal plot going. It's like she's got these powers. I mean, at least in his teaser, she was going for the big one. She was swinging for the fences.
Right.
I mean, so I like that. I also like, and this is something you got to give Stanley Ralph Ross some credit. And again, he obviously... Again, Jimmy, this goes with what, not knowing about the budget. He didn't know about the Horwitz-Dozier no martial arts edict because...
Right.
Yep. What's that?
Oh, no, I was going to say, there's a fight scene in there where Batgirl is getting loose.
Yeah, he and this was interesting too, and which also, and it also shows you how the hoops they had to go through in the actual episode to make Siren basically lose, is Siren has a much better plot in this plan in this one, where she just calls up Batman direct. She calls Batman, she breaks into Commissioner Gordon's office after he's gone for the night, and just calls Batman directly on the red phone, and just hits him with her note, and then hits Robin with the note, and tells them to go jump off Gotham City Bridge, and which makes a lot more sense than, you know, than her plot in the actual episode. Mm-hmm. And his thing is that, now he has a lot of stupid Stanley Ralph Ross stuff where, of course, Batman doesn't want to run any red lights on the way to the bridge because, you know, he's still civic responsibility. I guess that's funny. He's still civic responsibility, Batman, even though he's hypnotized.
Right.
And yeah. So I guess that's okay. But then, of course, Batman and Robin can't figure out who should jump off first. And then.
Yeah, and that's kind of weird, right? So they have to flip a coin.
That's silly. See, yeah. I don't mind you're right. I don't mind then the civic responsibility stuff that even under the spell he would be civic responsibility Batman. But you're going to follow her orders. You're not going to have to flip a coin. You're just going to jump. Mm-hmm. So that's silly. But then he has Batgirl basically karate chopping them to keep them from going over the side. So give him that much. He wasn't as much of a misogynist as the other two guys.
Mm-hmm.
He was okay with Batgirl using martial arts until obviously they told him no. So say that much about Stanley Ralph Ross. At least he was okay with Batgirl doing something other than ballet kicks.
Yeah, and you know, we don't, or do we know when it was written, that draft? That's probably well in advance. Do you think he knew he was writing for Joan Collins at that time?
He claims he did. I saw an interview once. I think it was in that thing that everyone always quotes, the Cinefantastique article from many, many moons ago. Now, he claims he did. Now, who knows if he did or didn't? I mean, you know, he could be an unreliable narrator, as we know. I mean, he claims that in the aired Catwoman two-parter with Eartha Kitt that there was a scene on a ferry, which, of course, there wasn't. Or that, but he claims he did. I mean, and I don't believe it was written for Eartha Kitt just because there's no singing scenes. Why would you have Eartha Kitt if you're not going to have a singing scene?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
If you're going to bring in an Eartha Kitt or, say, even from those days, a Julie London, you're going to have a singing scene. You're not going to waste having a great singer on and not have a singing scene. The whole reason you have, I don't know, I would assume the director or somebody else thought of it, because actually his original idea, Ross's original idea, Jimmy, was that she opened her mouth and nothing came out, which to me is stupid. It's even stupider than the emergency broadcast signal.
Right, but... Well, you could say that in sort of TV logic that they had to block it out, because if we heard it as viewers, then we'd be under her power.
Well, believe it or not, you know, I know I'm getting into tangents, but maybe people won't believe it. They actually, that was a thing in those days. Network executives worried about that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's crazy, but like there's a thing like the original, I haven't seen it yet, but there was like a Marcia, it may have been written by somebody else. There's like dueling Marcia scripts out there. There was somebody else wrote a Marcia script. In fact, I think this is the one they may have done in the comic, in the 66 comic, where she had a hypnotic chandelier.
You mean Marcia, Queen of the Diamonds?
Marcia, Queen of Diamonds. Yes, mm-hmm. So I should have made that clear. But there's a censor report where they say, you know, to not focus the camera too much on, like somebody, you know, what somebody at home was going to be hypnotized and send Carolyn Jones all his money. I mean,
well, yeah, I mean no, but I'm sure they were leery or weary of that lawsuit. You know, or
I know, it was a thing in those days that they worried. I mean, you know what? I guess they were right. Look at me, I'm still.
You're still under the spell. Yes, the three octaves above high C did a number on you.
Well, it was actually two. That remember, three is the antidote. But
thanks for the correction. So that's why you're the expert. Yes.
But you're right though. I think the other thing they couldn't have done also. I mean, at the end of two other points I should make about the outline, Jimmy, are it was funny though. Then he forgot about Batgirl because in the climactic fight scene, probably Horowitz writes in big letters, "Where's Batgirl?" He totally forgets.
Yeah, in
the
that
outline to put in Batgirl. Because remember, again, this is early June. He's not even thinking Batgirl yet. I mean, he knows she's there. He's got her early in the story, but it's not really ingrained in his mind yet. And then the other thing was that, like, this big Winnetka wind was supposedly going to sweep Siren away. I mean, I've even seen that done with CGI in movies. And even with CGI, it looks terrible. I can't imagine how much it would have cost, and secondly, how bad it would have looked in 1967 to try to pull that off.
And you said, so this is roughly in June when Stanley Ralph Ross was writing this. So he's just knocking out scripts and without any concern. And Dozier comes back and says,
this is where you pitch.
Yeah. Yeah.
You pitch the character and the thing and saying, and again, if we take him at his word, you're saying, okay, you've told me you want a script for Joan Collins. Here's my idea. Do you want me to go to script or not? And then basically they probably told him in a memo, in a phone call that we don't have access to, we like the idea for the character, but you saw some of the notation on it, but basically what you just said, Jimmy, too much money on the screen, too many extras. You got to find a way to do this in the studio. And like you said, hence they basically cut right to the grotto.
Yeah, more of a definitely might have flew at least that budget in season one, possibly season two.
Yeah, I mean, season one, I can at least see them at least looking for some stock footage.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see them.
And we would have gotten the two episodes out of it.
Yeah, and you can, as they say, amortize it. And then also I could see at least a scene of maybe Joan outdoors laughing, at the non-existent stock footage that she's looking at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I that's not impossible if you could somehow do that.
We could just have an older lady and a Boy Scout point in that direction and say, hey, look at the wind blew that lady off the hill. Again, you casual fans might not get that reference. I'm sure that's a good laugh for some of you deep cut guys.
Oh my! Well, no, if you stuck around for season three, you know that. Because I remember watching it. I'm like, again.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I guess they thought that was so funny that we got to keep wheeling them out there.
Right. The fans are expecting it. We got to use them. And then we'll bring this plane in, the Siren plane in for a landing. And JP, is there anything else you want to mention about the Siren before we wrap up that discussion?
Well, I would say again, I understand that the problems they were up against because, as I kind of alluded to before, Jimmy, let's face it, if she executes the plan the way she should, well, except for Batgirl, I mean, obviously being a woman and not and being immune to her, It's hard to defeat somebody that's got that kind of superpower. So they kind of painted themselves into a corner with a superpowered baddie. But I just think they could have done a better job with her. I just think the episode, again, as you said, it would have been nice to have a two-parter. Just let the episode breathe. I mean, she promised to ravage and pillage Gotham City like nobody's ever ravaged and pillaged it before. It would have been nice to see that actually happen. That would have been nice to see. But again, in the third season, that would have required actual actors and extras to have happen. If she knocks.
Or the aforementioned older lady in Boy Scout pointing.
Yeah, that too. You know, but if she's knocked, look at that. If she knocks over a jewelry store or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's going to, or she's got, I mean, how about if she gets a hold of the dispatcher and has all, well, not that they would be very effective, but it wouldn't be very effective henchmen, I guess, if she had the whole Gotham City Police Force under a spell. So I guess I should scotch that idea. It's not really a great...
No such thing as a bad idea. No such thing as a bad idea.
Really, skip that one. That's really... that would lead back to what I was against before. That'd be like one of those Newmar slow burns. Why can't I get good help? So yeah, you really don't want to bring those people on, those guys on board. That's probably not a good idea. But I'm just saying that you have this great kind of comic book villainous, and you kind of waste her, and you kind of waste Joan, and then you're going to give a second try to Louis the Lilac, and you're giving 3.5 hours to Olga. I mean, you got the. I mean, there's a difference between a comic book villainous and a cartoon villainous.
Gosh, let me politely disagree with the expert, JP. I don't think she was wasted at all. I thought she was a great character and well utilized. Maybe her potential was wasted, if I may.
Okay, that's the way to put it. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's the way to put it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's the way to put it. I mean, it's just, I feel that there was more potential.
Sure.
I think she deserved a two-parter.
And I certainly agree that I would have much rather seen her. And again, this is all retrospect. You know, they've got to go with the big money name like Uncle Milty. But I would have much rather enjoyed another episode, another treatment of the Siren than Louis the Lilac, and or maybe the Siren and Egghead instead of the Siren and
Olga. That would have been an interesting team up. That would have been an interesting team up.
Yeah.
To get him, because then you could get him back to his.
Or team her up with anybody.
I mean, also, you know, it's interesting, you know, by the way, Egghead and Siren had something in common because it was both written by Stanley Ralph Ross. They both called Bruce Wayne a fop. So there you go.
A fop?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Because Siren said he was a penniless fop when she took away. Although, again, let's face it. I mean, there was nobody there to notarize him signing over all his possessions. So that's really not binding yet.
Right,
but
right.
But if you remember Egghead, when he said, when he was going to put him in that machine, it was going to leave him an empty-headed fop. And they were going to switch their intellects.
That's, you know, almost the only time I've ever heard that word outside of learning the word was when I interviewed Kevin Conroy, famously voices Batman on the animated series and the games. And if there's a Batman voice in your head, it might be his. Right. He told me that's how he decided to play Bruce Wayne, is as a fop.
Interesting.
Yeah. So maybe he knew Stanley Ralph Ross.
Well, he comes across, you know, again, I'm going far afield here, but that's the way I think sometimes Bruce Wayne portrayed himself to try not to be thought of as Batman.
Right. That was his reason, Kevin's reasoning as well.
That's a good idea to try to deflect.
And he referenced the Scarlet Pimpernel when he was in that same discussion.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. But to the other thing I would also say about the Siren is that, again, it's too bad that she didn't come along. I think she's a season one villain stuck in season three. It just would have been nice to see. I mean, I don't know if they would go. I mean, you could say she's too outlandish, her powers are too outlandish for season one, but she just feels like season one because she's just very serious. She doesn't have a lot of yucks.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's back to season one of I want to unmask these guys.
Mm-hmm.
If I unmask them, I'll ruin them. That's very much a season one sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, a more thought out mission.
Yeah, and also that's the other thing. At least she has a. It's not a great plan, but like I said, because she could have just called the bat phone herself and had Batman in her power. That's, but
I love that part. Yeah.
But at least it's better than. I'm going to rule the world by having this the surfers or the hippies under my power. You know?
Well, if excellent point. Although I am a big fan of that episode, I mean, for various reasons, I'm a big fan of Surf's Up. But
I am too. Yeah. To me, that I know this is a tangent again, but I think that is the one time, the time where they most nailed the comedy. You know, it's at least.
Yeah, the ridiculousness of the comic books of the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Truncated into 24 minutes of screen time.
Yeah. If you're going to give me comedy, at least do it right. And that is so, the comedy of that, just the idea. Well, I'll say this. I have said this on the, you may have heard, I guess I'll wrap up the siren this way. Is I've always said, thank goodness there's no a siren experience and ability transferometer. Otherwise, you know, Joan would be in a lot of trouble.
Well, that brings us to the end of another exciting episode of the Powcast. Until JP joins us again, you can follow him on Twitter at JP Pelzman. That's at JPPELZMAN, or check out his sports coverage at Forbes.com. When we are allowed to go back outside again, please make sure you stop by the Hollywood Museum, located at the corner of Hollywood and Highland in Hollywood, California. Until then, you can stop by the website, thehollywoodmuseum.com. I wanted to say thanks again for your patience and support. We are all doing the best that we can during these trying and uncertain times, and I hope you are as well. We will be releasing episodes on a regular basis in the future, starting with a very special guest next time around. Here's a hint. When is a guest like a conundrum? Here's another hint. What do you call a seagull's painting? Follow us and say hi on the socials at RetroCoolNerd. Why not give our YouTube channel, RetroCoolNerd, a shake? I bet there's some videos on there you'd like. Stop by RetroCoolNerd.com on your daily interweb travels, and feel free to drop me an email anytime. That address is Jimmy@RetroCoolNerd.com. The music samples today were from the Flying Horse Big Band and the Batman soundtrack by Nelson Riddle and Neil Hefti. Special guest voices include Grayson and Jimmy Lazinski and Scott Sebring. Episode 3 of the Powcast has been written, recorded, and produced by me, Jimmy the Gent, in Wayne Study Studios for Saturday Morning Serial Productions. Tune in next time. Same Pow channel, same Powcast. Are you ready to get out of here, Bert?
To the Batmobile!
Yes.
Can we have the office back?